You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Toku Wingawa. No mai hari mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden, I'm your host for today, and I'll be with you for the next hour. Whai Akene, coming up on the show, I speak to Labour's Willow Jean Prime about the beginning of boot camps for youth offenders at the end of this month and funding cuts at Oranga Tamariki. I speak to Dr. Simone Watkins from the University of Auckland about the importance of equitable approaches for Māori, Pacific and Indian communities in our health system. And I speak to the University of Auckland's Liz Bedeau about the state of reproductive justice in the United States 2 years on from the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Sophia, what's on City Counselling today?
For City Counselling this week, I speak to Councillor Julie Ferry about flood prevention work in Mangere and Mirawai, as well as increasing public safety in Auckland's CBD.
And Tuesday Wire host Caster spoke to Professor of Business at the University of Auckland, Alex Sims, about the history and impact of planned obsolescence. He aha o whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wire mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e ware ware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ere kōrero ano, he pakihere roki roki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o Erarangi Pōho me haere ki 95 BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or call Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party.
The government's controversial boot camps for youth offenders begin on the 29th of July. These boot camps have been the subject of recent news due to their huge cost and military component. The arrival of boot camps comes as funding has been slashed at Oranga Tamariki, causing the organisation to abruptly cancel hundreds of contracts. These contracts included organisations who say the work they do is frontline, despite the government stating their funding cuts won't impact frontline workers. I speak to Labour spokesperson for children and youth, Willow Jean Prime, about both of these topics. Boot camps begin at the end of this month. Why has Labour been critical of them?
So we have been critical of this government's insistence on reintroducing boot camps, which is a failed policy of the past. This is an expensive experiment with our young people, and we believe that the military-style component of the program is completely unnecessary. This government should stop the nonsense and invest in real solutions.
There is some confusion about the role of the Defence Force in these camps. What do you know?
So what we know from official information that was released is that the Defence Force were concerned when Minister Mark Mitchell was comparing the boot camps to the LSV program. They outlined why he was wrong to do so, and also to clarify and that the Defence Force does not have a delivery role in terms of the boot camps. Subsequent to that official information coming out, Mark Mitchell continued to claim that the Defence Force were involved in the delivery of the boot camp. The Prime Minister contradicted his police minister and said it was right to describe or accurate to describe that they just have a governance role in terms of this program. It is very clear that nobody wants to be staffing this boot camp experiment.
The, as you say, expensive boot camps could cost up to $100,000 per teen. Where could the money be better spent?
It's actually more than $100,000 per team. That's just for the mentoring component, according to the latest information that we've received. This is over $5 million for this pilot for 10 young people. That money should be invested in young people, but it is better spent investing in programs that we know can and do work. And there are many out there in the community who I have been meeting with who are running programs that are working with our young people and having successful results. That's what this government should be investing in. When the government came in, they were provided with information about the Circuit Breaker program, which Labor introduced, and it has had an over 76% success rate. So the government should be spending that money, that same money, on the programs that are working and producing the results, as opposed to repeating past failed programs like boot camps.
And what are the differences between your program and the current government?
The key difference is this government is insisting on introducing a military-style component, the boot camp element, to their program. The 9 months of the program with wraparound services from the community is what Labor was doing and was investing in. But this government's tough-on-crime rhetoric and insistence on having a military-style component to the boot camp, to this program, is what concerns Labor, but it also concerns the Children's Commissioner. It concerns survivors who have been abused in state care. It has, it concerns many people who work with rangatahi who are seriously concerned about the negative impact that that will have on the young people who are in the program, because the decades of evidence shows us that it simply does not work. And so that same money should be spent on the programs that are working, that the government has acknowledged are important components to supporting our youth. So they should stop the nonsense with the boot camp and support the wraparound services that will work.
And this comes at the same time as a lot of cost-cutting in Oranga Tamariki and the youth justice sector. What could these cuts mean?
So these cuts are as a result of the Minister of Finance, Nicola Willis, requiring Oranga Tamariki to find 6.5% savings within the organisation. These cuts are going to impact on the front line. And the Minister of Finance said, don't worry, these will not impact the front line. But what we are seeing, what we are hearing, is that the cuts are deep and that they are impacting on frontline services. So over 419 roles have been cut within Oranga Tamariki. They are not just back office jobs. Some of those jobs are even in youth justice. And then we have $30 million a year being cut from contracts for services in communities with our community providers. And today there are stories of that being prevention programs and support programs for new parents. It is for counselling for girls who have been the victim of domestic violence. These are absolutely frontline services that are there for our most vulnerable children and families. So this government has got its priorities wrong.
This is also all within the context of your government beginning the inquiry into abuse and care, and now it's up to this government to complete it. Do you have any thoughts around this?
I was really concerned, alarmed actually, when I heard the Prime Minister say that or make excuses for one of his ministers who are going to be responsible for responding to this inquiry, that he hadn't read the report and that the report weighed something like 4 kilograms. This is a really important issue, a really important report. There are significant findings and recommendations in that report that everybody, and particularly this government, should be taking seriously. They should be taking the time to consider that report and reflecting on the policies that they are looking to introduce. These boot camps start in, under 2 weeks. They should be taking the time to consider that report and those recommendations and reflect on the policies that they are looking to implement, because we do not want to repeat those serious wrongs of the past.
Given the 7AA section appeal, do you have any particular concerns about how this government is managing Māori, Tamariki and Rangatahi in state care?
I have huge concerns with the minister's insistence on the repeal of Section 7AA, which is the treaty clause within Oranga Tamariki's legislation. Her reasons for wanting to repeal the legislation are political ideology. They are not backed up by empirical evidence that there is any conflict between Section 7AA and the best interests of the child and care decisions. The minister refuses to listen to the untold evidence and stories about that and continues to insist on its repeal. One of my key concerns about that is that section was introduced because Oranga Tamariki had not partnered well and upheld its treaty obligations in the past. And there's a key section within it where the organisation is required to demonstrate how they are reducing disparities for Māori. Māori tamariki are overrepresented in Oranga Tamariki. And so without those key things in the legislation that are not about care decisions, they are other really key mechanisms within the legislation to ensure that we are upholding Te Tiriti o Waitangi, that we are partnering with Māori, that we are demonstrating how we are reducing the disparities for Māori within Oranga Tamariki, all gone because of this minister's political ideology.
What about Karen Shaw, who is Māori and has been in state care and defends this action? What would you say to her?
She has no empirical evidence that there is an issue with Section 7AA. The cases that she uses to defend her position have been explained that those are social worker practice issues and are not directly related to Section 7AA. She has no empirical evidence. It is all anecdotal. And that is a real concern, that she is not prepared to listen to the strength of the evidence that is before her and reconsider her position on the removal of Section 7AA.
And what is your message to the rangatahi and tamariki in the care of Oranga Tamariki who feel hopeless and isolated right now?
There are many who want to support our rangatahi. We are fighting hard to make sure that this government is making decisions in the best interests of our young people who are in care. They have organisations like Voice Whakarongo Mai who are there to support those in care to have a voice in these processes, and I really encourage them to reach out to Voice Whakarongo Mai or to other organisations that they might have a relationship with to ensure that their voices are heard by this government, because their voices are what is most important in all of this conversation. So it's important that we have an avenue for them to express their views.
That was Labour's Willow Jean Prime on boot camps for youth offenders and funding cuts at Oranga Tamariki.
That was our weekly chat with the Labour Party.
93, 94, 95 BFM.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95 BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland Council wants to fast-track plans that would prevent 51 homes from being demolished in Mangere due to flood risk. This comes after the council endorsed flood resilience projects in Mangere and Mirawai as part of a wider Making Space for Water program. Additionally, police presence in Auckland CBD increased last week, with another 21 police added to downtown police patrols. This is part of an effort to uplift their beat presence in light of increases in antisocial behaviour, leaving many people feeling increasingly unsafe in the area. I spoke to Councillor for Alba Eden Poketapapa, Julie Ferry, about these topics, starting the interview asking her about the flood prevention work in Mangere.
So the fast tracking is so that we can give people who live there certainty, and it's not fast tracking under the new legislation or under the COVID legislation. It's actually a different process under the Severe Weather Emergency Response Legislation Act, known as SWERLA, which just means that we use what's called an order in council, which goes to the full executive council, so all of the ministers. It also requires some public engagement, which will happen starting towards the end of the month. So it's quite a different process from the fast track legislation. That's up for the moment. It's only overseen by three ministers. So just to clarify that. For Mangere in particular, there's two stream catchments involved which overlap a little bit. So there's the Te Ararata catchment. We will be increasing the stream capacity under the Wormsley Road Bridge, improving the maintenance access for the Mahunga Drive culverts and installing debris capture devices along the Te Ararata stream. The bridge work under the Wormsley Road Bridge in particular is quite complex and expensive. Then in the Haranui catchment, there's replacing embankments at Tennessee Ave and Blake Road with an open stream, so that's quite cool. It's going to be some daylighting of the stream, and there'll be some pipe bridges as well. There's also enhancing that newly created stream area with landscaping and planting, and so people like the Te Ararata stream team, the local board, the local community will be really involved, particularly in that planting side.
And this comes alongside endorsing flood resilience projects in Mirawai as well. What's the update on progress there?
So for Mirawai, the works there will impact on around 60 properties, which will reduce their flood risk, but there's also four of those 60 will also be protected from landslide risk. So people will recall there was quite a significant landslide in Mirawai. Unfortunately, two lives were lost in that as well. And so the work there is sort of twofold. There's the flooding risk. There's also some properties that are going to be helped with landslide risk. There's going to be installing of a stop bank there on Domain Crescent, upgrading open channel roadside drains and driveway crossings on Motutara Road, and also installing sediment and debris traps in the area, which will reduce blockages, make maintenance easier, that kind of thing. That one, that package is going to cost about $5 million, and the Mangere package is about $53 million, just to give you a sense of, you know, the different size of scopes of those works.
And how does this work in Mangere and Mirawai fit into the work changing the Auckland Unitary Plan and Council's commitment to increase resilience to natural hazards?
So the unitary plan at the moment allows for, and people might have seen, resource consents going through under old rules that applied before we had the storms and before we had that really huge impact that showed us that a lot of our systems aren't necessarily up to the task of the kind of rainfall that we're likely to get in the future with climate change. So what we're doing is we're working on what's called a natural hazards plan change, which will go out for consultation probably early next year. And that looks not just at the areas that were impacted in the particular severe weather events that happened in 2023, but also looks more broadly at updating all of our maps around flood risk, around coastal inundation and around overland flow paths. And so people will see some changes once that all goes through the process, and there'll be public consultation and hearings and all of that kind of stuff, as there usually is with a plan change. People will see changes to what they can and can't do on their properties as we update that. The other thing that works in with is the categorisation process, which is where individual properties that were impacted in those flood events and the cyclone are able to be assessed and potentially be offered a buyout if there is intolerable risk to life that we can't address quickly through the kinds of changes that we're making in Mirawai and Mangere in the next wee while. There's plans afoot for huge other areas of Auckland as well, including quite a lot in the area I represent, so around the Te Aonga Oakley Creek catchment, The Neola Waitatiko catchment, Motions Creek, Cox's Bay, Waito Valley, the Faux River, there's heaps of work underway to do the kinds of things we're doing in Mangere and Miruai, but those ones we can do quite quickly. They're relatively straightforward. The other ones are much more complex and are going to rely in part on which pieces of land we do buy through the categorisation process.
And I wanted to ask you about safety in Auckland CBD. In briefings to the Police Minister, Mark Mitchell, in May, increases in antisocial behaviour, social housing and emergency accommodation, alcohol and drugs, and the impact of the City Rail Link construction were reasons listed as to why people are feeling more unsafe at the moment. How is Auckland Council working to address this?
Well, I sit on the Regulatory and Safety Committee, which is chaired by Councillor Jo Bartley, my neighbour to the east, and she is really interested in exploring this because there's two aspects to it which sometimes get dealt with together. One is the issue about homelessness, which presents in the city centre, because that's a relatively, I wouldn't say easy, because nowhere's easy to be homeless, but it's a place where people who are without shelter can access more services, can potentially raise a bit of money through begging, that kind of stuff. So there's work on that, and then separately there's work on the antisocial stuff. And there tends to be a bit of conflation of the two, which is really unhelpful, because largely it's actually two different groups of people. Sometimes we do have some issues with beggars becoming more aggressive, but actually that's really not the bigger issue. Those people are getting a lot of help through the City Mission, who have their new building Home Ground, which is an amazing wraparound service for people, but we probably need about six of them in order to deal with the numbers. But then separate from that, there is a group of people who are behaving badly in the city centre, who are taking part in crime, who are using drugs in the open, alcohol, all of that kind of stuff. By and large, they're two separate groups of people, so I just wanted to be really clear about that. There is the Community Patrol NZ, which, with support from the Mayor, has been doing a lot of work in the city centre doing special patrols. There's City Watch, which is funded by Heart of the City and operates 24/7 in the city centre. That's funded through a targeted rate that all the businesses in the city centre pay through council. The Waitematau Local Board is doing quite a lot of sort of community activation of some of the open spaces to change the vibe and get more people into them in a way that means that they're not attractive spaces for people to do bad stuff. There's also the safety hubs that are happening with the police, but ultimately we don't have a city centre police station, and I think that's what a lot of people are pushing for and see as a need, and I know that's something the Waitematau Local Board are pushing for too. There hasn't been a city centre police station for quite a long time. I remember the old one at Vincent Street, still got, I can see it from my office, and it still has 800 new cops on the top of the building, but there's no police actually based there, and so there is a lot of interest in how can we turn that around. Is the government interested in reinstating some kind of city centre police station, even if it's something like the Newmarket one, which is kind of quite a small sort of one? That kind of stuff just helps to raise expectations of people's behaviour and serve as a base for cops who are on the beat as well.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how the council is working alongside police on this issue and to maybe start up that hub?
Yeah, so the safety hubs actually originally evolved out of some work that was done through the FIFA, the Women's World Cup, and they put some safety hubs in the city centre as sort of a trial to see. And so they're sort of these like pop-up, almost like food trucks but police stations, if that makes sense. And they've identified a number of locations where those are going in, and obviously they're fully supported by police, but they are very much pop-ups. Midtown is one of the particularly risky areas. Risky is probably overstating it, but there's quite a lot of work happening through the city centre targeted rate on activating that area. So, for example, quite often on Thursday nights, there'll be little street festivals in the Midtown area based on Elliot Street and Derby Street, activating the Strand Arcade, which I remember when it was full of shops as a kid coming into the city, and these days it's got a lot of vacancies, but they have a lot of pop-ups there. And so some of that kind of stuff is about, as I say, activating the space, and then some of it is about working with police on the enforcement as well. And CPNZ are playing, which is Community Patrols NZ, are playing quite a big role there, sort of in between the community activations and the police. You have volunteers who are effectively going out on patrols. I've been out with a couple of them in my part of the city, and they're just sort of increasing that visibility, often supporting in particular liquor premises and off licences, and giving them, you know, sort of that eyes on the street stuff, which then can report back to the police as well.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry speaking to me about flood prevention work in Mangere and Murawai, as well as increasing public safety in Auckland CBD.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Get some floss because you're going to be picking popcorn out of your teeth all August.
Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival is back for 2024, August 7 to 18th.
Tickets are on sale now, so message the group chat, get online and get booking before it starts selling out.
Whānau Marama, New Zealand International Film Festival, August 7 to 18. For schedule and tickets, go to nziff.co.nz.
Wow, music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them in a special Spotify playlist just for you.
The July playlist is up now and features music from T.G. Shand, Earth Tongue, Memory Foam, Mystery Waitress, Fontaines DC, and so much more.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for a monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
Sad about it, sad about it, like you. And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, Texts and Your Thoughts 5395. It has been 2 years since the Supreme Court of the United States decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. This effectively reversed a recognized constitutional right for abortion in the United States, paving the way for some states to ban abortions completely. I spoke to the University of Auckland's Liz Bedeau about what the impact in the United States has been and if there could still be potential ramifications of decisions here in Aotearoa. 2 years on from Roe v. Wade, what do we know about the situation in the United States?
It's really complex and very dire, to be honest. I think it's important to start with noting that, you know, abortion rights, abortion healthcare was under threat before that decision about Roe v. Wade. So there were already, you know, very, very potent threats against reproductive rights and reproductive justice. So what happened after Roe v. Wade fell was that there were a lot of trigger bans in place. A lot of states had legislation ready to go to ban abortion, and those things happened very, very quickly. So over the last 2 years, a situation that was already bad has got considerably worse. I had a look yesterday at information that the Guttmacher Institute collects. They're sort of a watchdog group that keeps a very close eye on what's happening in abortion and other aspects of reproductive care. And they have a good interactive map that tells us that 16 states in the US have total bans on abortion. 17 have bans on abortion or bans that would restrict abortion to under 6 weeks, and most people don't necessarily have a confirmed pregnancy result under 6 weeks, so it's essentially a total ban. And there are 20 states that have bans that would include bans on, even if there are some sort of rights to have abortion earlier on, there will be bans at later stages of pregnancy, for example, 12 to 15 weeks. Guttmacher also reports that only 4 states in the US have constitutional provisions that protect abortion rights. So it's a pretty serious situation, and it's ongoing because there are there's legislation being passed at state level across the US. There have been about 670-odd provisions introduced that would restrict access to abortion. 80 of those provisions have been enacted and 13 blocked, and so there's an awful lot of legislation that's before various kinds of state legislatures that may or may not result in more bans. So that's broadly the situation, but there are obviously impacts of that as well.
And is this situation likely to stay the same?
Everything's a bit in limbo at the moment also because it's an election year, and because this is such a powerful issue in American politics, neither Republicans nor Democrats particularly want to have a radical approach at this point. It's likely just to continue in the current climate. And what we do know is that there is a real threat to broaden the attack on abortion to include attacks on contraception. One of the problems that we have in relation to contraception is that there's a great deal of misinformation, and it's deliberately spread misinformation, so effectively disinformation, that claims that many forms of contraception are actually abortions, and they're not. Most common forms of contraception prevent pregnancies from occurring, and that's the whole point of them. But there's a lot of information around that, you know, for example, intrauterine devices cause abortions, that kind of thing. So we do see in some areas real potent threats to the rights of people to use contraception. It's also broadened out to things like, you know, the kind of attacks go hand in hand with attacks on gender-affirming healthcare, for example. So they're all linked to a sort of general kind of, I like to refer to it as a kind of coercive control over people, particularly women and non-binary people, minority people who face these attacks on their personal rights. So I think there's a lot going on, and a lot of work also happening on the positive note, that there are huge efforts to lobby to prevent some of these more draconian things happening. And I mean, one of the things that Guttmacher reports is that there's been an actual increase in the number of abortions in states where abortion care remains legal in comparison to 2020. So there's been an increase in abortions, and that is largely driven by out-of-state residents. So they report a huge influx of people travelling from out-of-state in the first half of last year compared to 2020 in those states that have protective policies, so policies that are ensuring that abortion services are still available.
And what could the current presidential race mean for reproductive rights?
I think the biggest concern that many people have it relates to the 2025 project, which is, I mean, Trump has not sort of come out and said that he's going to institute everything on that 2025 project list, but it's a very powerful list of things that extreme right wing want to change. It includes things like regarding any information about rainbow communities, any information about people who are non-binary or questioning their gender identity to be regarded as pornographic, one of the most more extreme measures that I saw reported yesterday was that people, librarians or teachers who shared information that might be helpful to young people questioning their gender, for example, might be considered to be sex offenders for sharing that information. They also want to ban contraception entirely. And there is a potent threat, I think, also to IVF because of the view that IVF... it essentially ends the life of embryos that are not used in IVF treatment for infertility. So it's pretty extreme. There's a lot of pushback, and there will continue to be pushback even if Trump does get elected. If Trump doesn't get elected, who knows what will happen. Biden has resisted being too visible on this issue. But the Democratic Party has a very strong lobby within it to kind of protect and support rights to abortion as a form of healthcare.
At the time of the overturning of Roe v. Wade, there was some discussions the decision could have ramifications in Aotearoa. Is this still the case?
Yes, it is. I think that anything that happens in the US that is particularly heavily funded by lobby groups has an impact here. We know, for example, that there are so-called pregnancy counselling services or pregnancy crisis clinics that are funded with US money that essentially offer to help people who are considering having an abortion because they have an unplanned or unwanted pregnancy. And those clinics specialise in giving misinformation and disinformation to people who are vulnerable. One of the things that happened quite recently here is that our Ministry of Health put out quite recently, just like last week, I think, or the week before, a position statement on abortion reversal, which is the idea that giving particular medical treatment can reverse abortions. The Ministry had to come out and say that it doesn't support the practice. There's no medical evidence, there's no adequate research to support the idea of abortion reversal. In fact, clinical trials have found abortion reversal not effective and could lead to side effects and adverse outcomes. So the major medical bodies have agreed this. An interesting thing in the Ministry of Health statement that came out was that anyone who promotes abortion reversal is potentially breaching Section 20, or whatever it is, of the Medicines Act, because it's not approved for purpose. So those kinds of breaches could lead to quite serious penalties. They also make the point that early medical abortion, and that is, you know, abortion that uses medication to end a pregnancy rather than surgery, that's a safe form of abortion and it's effective, and that people can get support and information from legitimate health sources, for example, the Decide service, which is funded through government, through health. I think one of the other things that it's important to think about with restricting abortion and restricting contraception ultimately is that these kinds of measures disproportionately affect people who are already vulnerable. And one of the things that's important to think about in our context is concerns about maternal health, maternal well-being. I was looking at a US study that estimated that a total abortion ban in the United States would potentially result in an additional 21% increase in maternal deaths. And those kinds of poor maternal health outcomes, maternal deaths, already are disproportionately affecting, in America, African-American people, Hispanic people, other minorities that are racialized. And we could expect to see the same kinds of problems here. We know, for example, that Māori and Pacific women have, you know, higher rates of problem pregnancies and poorer maternal health, including maternal mental health. So bans on abortion, bans on contraception have real downstream impacts on people's overall well-being. And we are very concerned that you know, the more of this kind of misinformation and disinformation that is imported from the US and funded by these lobby groups who are hostile to the rights of people to make personal decisions with good information and support, you know, that can really have an impact.
That was the University of Auckland's Liz Badeau on the situation 2 years on from the overturning of Roe v. Wade.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Planned obsolescence is a concept introduced by businesses to increase income by forcing customers to buy more products. Though these products may be cheaper in the short term, having to buy more products makes it more expensive in the long term. Tuesday Wire host Kester spoke to Professor of Business at the University of Auckland, Alex Sims, about the history and impacts of planned obsolescence.
Could you briefly just explain for us, sort of to get into it, what planned obsolescence is?
Okay, well, planned obsolescence is essentially producing a product that is designed or planned not to have as long a lifespan as it could.
And when did we start seeing planned obsolescence in products? I guess what's the rationale as well behind it?
Well, the first sort of reported case is back almost 100 years ago, called the Phoebus cartels. So that was where we had light bulbs, and the light bulbs were lasting quite a long time. And so the main light bulb manufacturers got together and they said, right, if we can make them last not as long, we'll have more sales because people will have to buy light bulbs more frequently. And so that's the first documented one. And they had an agreement that they would get down from, say, 2,500 hours down to 1,500 hours, and they did. And also what they did, they had an agreement where if you were a manufacturer and you had light bulbs that lasted too long, then you were fined. I mean, now in New Zealand, of course, that is illegal, but I mean, people break laws all the time.
Yeah, and do we see that a lot more in the present day across sectors, I'm assuming, as well as light bulbs? We see it in other products.
Well, now they don't get together like that because that's illegal. But, I mean, we've seen it. I mean, I'm older than you, but the piece that I wrote on this, it was very common for people to have appliances that lasted for their whole lives, whereas now you think of something like a dishwasher or a fridge, and especially a dishwasher, you're lucky if you get 10 years out of it.
Yeah, right. And then what, obviously there's an impact on people there with having to spend extra money. Are there other, like, environmental impacts of something like planned obsolescence?
Well, yes, there's huge environmental impacts because you're having to mine all of that material. Most of the stuff is not recycled. In New Zealand, the estimate is only 2% of e-waste is actually recycled. And even if you do recycle it, you've still got big environmental damage because of the, you know, having to heat it, it just toxins and things like that. So in terms of the environment, it's much, much, much better to keep that, keep the one thing in operation and just change, you know, a spare part or two.
Yeah, and then lastly, what are some of the main products we see planned obsolescence show up in?
I would say everything.
Right, so just across all sorts of technology, appliances, that sort of thing?
Yes, I mean, there are some manufacturers who do a lot better than others.
Mm.
And so, for example, in France, they've got a scheme where you have to have labels on products that tell you about repairs and things like that. But what they're changing it to is more durability. So how long does it last? And so until we get something like that in New Zealand, which hopefully we do eventually, is that people, if they're looking to buy something, is buying, do your research and buy products that last for longer, because you'll be able to, should be able to find that out. And yes, they can cost a bit more, but if you're worried about the environment, then do that. Or of course, the secondhand one as well. So for example, my household, we try to buy as much as possible secondhand, and often those secondhand goods are a lot more durable than the newer ones.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I guess it's getting worse. So as I said, it's not new, but it's accelerating, and people are just so used to having to buy new. But also, just actually one quick thing is that repair. I mean, manufacturers do try to make things harder to repair, for example, by using glue and other things. But some things can be repaired. And, for example, there's repair cafes and other things. And so just think about that. Yeah, it may not work quite well. But also just think, is it working? Just keep it. Don't get the next model up when it's working perfectly well.
That was Professor of Business at the University of Auckland, Alex Sims, speaking about the history and impacts of planned obsolescence.
93, 94, 95 BFM.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts, 5395.
Knew you'd take me back. around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Nicola Willis said this year's budget delivers to Māori because when a New Zealander turns up to an emergency room or a school, they don't turn up thinking about their ethnicity. This comment was met with criticism, including from Associate Professor Marama Muru Lunning, who responded, "When a Māori turns up at a hospital, they know they are Māori. They never forget that, and they're only there because they absolutely have to be there." I spoke to the University of Auckland's Dr. Simone Watkins about the government's equal approach to healthcare and how this continues to disadvantage people who are Māori, Pacifica and Indian. I started by asking what the unequal health outcomes are.
So we know that the survival of babies, particularly Māori, Pacific and Indian babies compared to Europeans, are not the same in New Zealand. And a recent report shows that that hasn't really changed for the last 20 years. And so this is a particular area of concern, as these are the vulnerable children. You know, these aren't necessarily direct influences of any of their health decisions in this country. So that's quite a concerning statistic.
How does a one-size-fits-all approach to our health system fail to address this?
I think the facts and evidence that continually show these poorer survival and other inferior health outcomes for our Indigenous Māori, Pacific and other ethnic groups in New Zealand, apart from European or Pakeha, is the evidence enough to show that just that one-size-fits-all approach or trying to give the equal chances and opportunities to everyone doesn't shift those disparity statistics enough for our health outcomes in New Zealand. And in this day and age of modern medicine and the opportunities we have and the evidence that we have gathered through research, we know that there are different approaches that could improve those health outcomes for our Māori and Pacific people in New Zealand. And I think we need to really use those evidence-based approaches to try and have culturally informed agency and methods that are going to be more successful in closing that disparity gap, particularly over survival for our Tamariki and Aotearoa New Zealand.
Pākehā have complained that this is unequal, but is there a difference between equality and equity?
Yeah, I think this is a common misinterpretation or mistake that equality and equity are the same. So equality means that you're giving everybody exactly the same healthcare in the same way, and equity means that you're meeting the different needs of the different population groups, so that the distribution may not look equal, but you're trying to even the playing field, so to speak, so that you can try and get more equal outcomes at the end of that. So looking at trying to, you know, have the survival chances of a baby born in Aotearoa New Zealand be the same no matter what ethnic group they belong to. That's really what the goal is. And that universalism approach really isn't working for us, and we need to try and approach things differently, which is where Te Aka Whai Ora and the agency over the healthcare system was looking really promising, and trying to deconstruct those things and go back to just everybody gets the same healthcare and it's fit for all New Zealanders. I think that's really not speaking to what the healthcare evidence and research has shown us so far.
And does that mean the government's proposed solutions will make things worse?
I do fear that it might make things worse. I mean, that's what we're seeing to date. And we just haven't given some healthcare system changes enough time to really show those increased outcomes. And we know that overseas that there have been different changes that they've implemented that have been quite simple in some healthcare systems to ensure that there's transparency in systems and sites that allow for equality of outcomes in healthcare settings. For example, they've looked at infections at infection sites and intensive care, and they've changed the way that they've been monitoring it so that in America the blacks had the same outcomes as the whites, for example. So we know there are different approaches that can try and help all the different patients, and I think we need to try and take all of the knowledge that's been done and over all the years overseas and here and try and apply it in our setting to, yeah, increase the survival chances of our most vulnerable New Zealanders. And I think that that's something that we should all care about as New Zealanders for everyone in this country, because we all deserve those equal opportunities, particularly for our younger and most vulnerable patients.
You mentioned that Māori, Pacifica and Indian newborns are worse off under our health system compared to Pākehā newborns. Are there other areas of our health system where this continues to be the case?
Yes, so we know that the disparities in health outcomes and survival chances and life expectancy, this is uniform across all the different areas. And even in my own research, we know that the infant outcomes up to 1 year for congenital heart disease or inborn heart problems are different for Māori and Pacifica compared to Europeans. And so my research has been looking at the underlying causes of why that might be happening, and I think we need to focus our research and resources into looking at why these disparities keep happening and what interventions are going to be successful rather than just continuing to report the same thing. And I think that if we just continue doing what we've always done, we will get the same result. And so I think that we just do need to pivot and look at, you know, how can we best service the needs of all of the individuals that we have in New Zealand.
That was Dr. Simone Watkins on the inequitable health outcomes between ethnicities in the Aotearoa healthcare system.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa hi kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The Labour Party's Willow Jean Prime, the University of Auckland's Dr. Simone Watkins, the University of Auckland's Liz Bedeau, Auckland Councillor Julie Ferry, and the University of Auckland's Alex Sims. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Eli. I don't even try. I don't have to think.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.